Working Cows Podcast, Episode 67.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, brought to you by the Global Ag Network. In preparation for the Global Ag Network bringing in some sponsors, I'm going to start giving some shout-outs to my Patreon supporters, but we will talk about them a little bit later in the show. Today, we have Gabe Brown on. Gabe is a rancher in Bismarck, North Dakota. If you don't know about him already, you're in for a treat. This is kind of the kickoff to 2019 with some big national and international guests. I'm really excited to have Gabe Brown on to talk about his new book, Dirt to Soil, One Family's Journey into Regenerative Agriculture. So, Gabe, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I had reached out to my private Facebook group for the Working Cows Podcast and asked them if they had any questions for you, and I got a few responses back, and one of them is related to something that you said early on in the book, that planting some perennial crops or some perennials on crop land led to one of the hardest lessons that you learned in your process, and that's where you start in your book, is lessons that you learned the hard way. And so I'd just like to ask you, what was it about the way soil functions that you learned in that time, and what made that the hardest lesson that you learned?
Well, what it was is that we had a couple hundred acres that was farmed, and it had been heavily tilled for many years, monoculture, grain production. And I decided I wanted some cool season pasture, so I went into NRCS and asked them what they recommended, and they recommended a mix of smooth brome grass, intermediate, and pubescent wheatgrass. And so I seeded those couple hundred acres back to that, got a beautiful stand, but very low productivity. And I just wasn't getting enough production from it to justify having it in those perennial forages. And what I learned was that the land, the soil, was degraded because of the way it had been farmed for years. There was no soil aggregates, thus I had very poor water infiltration. If you don't have soil aggregates, you do not have a home for much soil biology, so we had very poor nutrient cycling. The forages that did grow, they wouldn't even head out because of the lack of nutrients. And I went to Extension, et cetera, and asked them, well, what can I do to make this productive? Well, their response was fertilize it. Well, at that time, I was going through some years of hail and drought, and I didn't have money to fertilize it. And I realized that I needed to learn how could I make that soil productive, and what it takes is diversity. And so if I had to do that same scenario over again, what I would have done is seeded that cropland to cover crops for a couple of years, different species at different times of the year, and I would have integrated livestock, and that would have helped that soil to build soil aggregates, jumpstart nutrient cycling. The diversity would have been there to stimulate the feed of biology via root exudates. Then I would have went in and seeded perennials, and I would have had a much better stand. It would have been much more productive. The water cycle would have been functioning at a much higher rate. And so that was a lesson learned, but it was a good one, because now whenever we go to seed cropland back to perennials, we use that protocol of doing a couple years of cover crops first with animals grazing those covers, and it's really made a big difference.
that leads nicely into another question that I got from another listener, a friend here in Western South Dakota. I reached out to him, and he said he'd like to know the right process for starting to no-till cover crop mixtures into old hay fields, and these would be perennial hay fields, mostly crested wheat, some scattered alfalfa, a bit of brome grass. He wants to plant in the spring and plant all summer into the fall so that he has something to graze at different times. And he would like to stay away from spray if possible. So you got any idea on that?
Boy, he's not making it easy for me, is he? So I often get asked that question, and here's what I tell people. Realize that it's difficult for any seed to compete with an established perennial plant that's already been growing for a number of years. Add to that species such as crested wheatgrass sends out an allelopathic effect that actually inhibits some other seeds from germinating. The best way to do it that I've found is you have to have a window of time where the forages, the perennial forages that are there, are starting to go into dormancy. And I've actually found it's better to go into those hay fields in late fall after several killing frosts and then establish a crop such as cereal rye and hairy vetch. Could be winter triticale, could be winter wheat and hairy vetch. Get those established in the fall because you usually get enough moisture to germinate them, and they're more cold tolerant than are some of the smooth bromes, crested wheat, and certainly alfalfa. Alfalfa will have gone dormant. Then what happens in the spring of the year, that'll actually start growing, and I'm not going to say crested wheat is a tough one to get it established in, but we've had decent luck in smooth brome and excellent luck into alfalfa stands with it. Then you graze that, whether it's winter wheat, rye, winter triticale, and vetch, you graze that with livestock when it's appropriate, late May or June. Then immediately when you're done grazing it, you go in with what I call a warm season mix. So it'd be comprised of species such as sorghum sedan grass and millets and cowpeas and, in other words, heat tolerant species, and that then, obviously your cool season crested and smooth brome will be starting to shut down. Those species, if you have the moisture available, will grow and provide you biomass for grazing later in the year. By doing that 1 year cycle, I've had decent success with going in the second year then and seeding very early, such a cool tolerant forages such as oats or field peas, a forage brassica. And if I get that in early, or as soon as the snow starts to leave, I can actually get those to perform decent. I'm not going to say fantastic, but decent. Then I go with another warm season mix, and then the third year I'll actually go in then and I will seed whatever, if my intention is to keep it into perennial forages for grazing, I would go back in and seed those whatever perennial species I would like in that mix. And that species of, we want a mix certainly of several grasses and several forbs and some legume component, although one of the things we're seeing, people often are way too heavy on the legume component in the mixes and not enough forbs and grasses.
Very, very helpful, very practical. Appreciate that very much. I guess for my own personal benefit and curiosity, is there a place for a monoculture in production agriculture in your mind?
Well, let's be honest that with the ramifications of the current production model, we're going to see some people plant monocultures. And what I tell people is don't beat yourself up for doing so. If it's in a grain type situation where you want a specific grain for seed, etc. And, you know, I say even I do that on a rare occasion, but if I do, I make sure and have a cover crop either before that monoculture crop or after it, a very diverse cover crop, so we can get some diversity into those soils. And I tell people the way you have to look at that is, tell me in nature, where do you find monocultures? You don't. You know, usually it's only where man or man's management or stewardship or lack thereof has caused them to occur. So because of that, we want diversity as much as possible.
And what are some of the ways that, or what are some methods or some ways of starting out in getting to a more regenerative style of agriculture that can give people the best kind of bang for their buck or help them get started off on the right foot? What are some things?
That's a very good question. And I tell people we have to find the window of time that allows us to get these cover crops established. And, you know, I'm assuming the majority of your listeners are interested in grazing livestock. So when is there a window of time in my crop rotation that I can get a cover crop started? Well, for many people, you know, they're seeding spring wheat, et cetera, or corn or soybeans. And, you know, let's be honest, there isn't enough time in our northern environment to get a decent cover crop established after any of those. So what I started doing on our operation, we took a percentage of the cropland, and instead of growing a cash crop, I grow what I call double crop cover crops. So we'll use the cereal rye and hairy vetch, and then we'll graze that off, and, you know, we'll plant it the fall before, graze it in late May and June, and then we will immediately follow with that diverse warm season mix. So the cover crops actually become my cash crop for the year. What that allows is it allows us the ability to very rapidly advance soil aggregation. You know, we're taking and all farming is about a flow of energy. It's about taking carbon out of the atmosphere and photosynthesizing it through the plant, pumping those root exudates out to feed biology and to build soil aggregates, and that's what drives the profitability of our whole system. So we use cover crops then to advance soil health quickly, and the livestock convert those cover crops to dollars, you know, to make up for some of the lost income because we don't have a cash crop. And subsequent crops will certainly benefit substantially from that year of cover crops.
You mentioned northern climates being a limiting factor in how we manage our resources. Actually, one of my previous guests and a member of my private Facebook group is in the tropics of Mexico, and he's wondering about, you know, different cover crop mixtures for different regions and different climates and some of those things, and some different things that you've seen work in other areas. I guess I'm assuming you've been exposed to other areas that are using these methods.
Oh, sure. And I tell people that's the beautiful thing about the five principles of a healthy soil ecosystem. You know, those being least amount of mechanical and chemical disturbance possible, armor or skin on the soil surface, diversity, living root in the ground as long as possible throughout the year, and animal integration. Those five principles are constant anywhere in the world where there's production-based agriculture on land. Those five principles are the same. And I've seen it working in Mexico and Australia and New Zealand and South Africa and Germany and England, you name it, it just works. And you know, the tools we use, the varieties of cover crops, the species of livestock, the implements, they may be different, but those principles are universal.
Gabe, I'd just like to take a break real quick to thank the supporters on Patreon, some great folks who've been supporting me out there, Ryan and Bridger and Jerry and Mark and Daniel and George and Rachel. Thank you guys so much for your generous support of the show. I have seen a lot of growth over this holiday break of Patreon supporters coming in and some very generous ones, and I've got some T-shirts getting printed up and some hats getting printed up to be sent out to those supporters here in the very near future. So really excited about that. And don't worry, you'll be able to buy the T-shirts as well. I'll have a link up to that as soon as I've got the T-shirts out to my Patreon supporters. I don't want to spoil it. I want it to be a surprise, so keep a lookout for that. So thank you for your support. Gabe, you show in your book a graph of different ranches and their kind of the soil health and the picture of soil health on those. And if I understand the graph correctly, in the book it says that your ranch can infiltrate 30 inches of water per hour. Is that right?
Yeah, we have had scientists document that on land where I once, well, in 1991, we could infiltrate half of an inch per hour. Now we can infiltrate up to 30 inches in an hour. And that all comes about from building soil aggregates. And that all comes about strictly because of management, or I like to call it stewardship.
So then what is a flood? That was a, you know, I mean, have you, do you guys, if you're infiltrating that much water, it's probably rare that it pools on the surface and runs
off.
The
only place you'll see water running off our land is on a road or a trail of some kind. It's just, you know, where I have a little compaction issue. And once in a while at the end of the field, if you had the combine or truck sitting there long enough, you'll have a little compaction. But no, our goal and our, you know, we only get 15 to 16 inches of precip a year. It's imperative that we infiltrate every single raindrop or snowflake, you know, where it falls and melts. We just have to. That's key. And I tell people, it makes no difference. And, you know, I'm on hundreds of operations every year. And I tell people, they'll tell me how much rainfall they get, and I'll tell them, well, that doesn't matter at all. Rainfall doesn't matter. What matters is how much can you infiltrate and then store in your soils via the organic matter levels you have. And unfortunately, in production agriculture today, and I tell people this, I have never been on an operation, including my own, that's not degraded. You know, we have a fraction of the soil aggregation and soil health that we once had. And the goal is to regenerate these ecosystems back to a point of much higher productivity.
So which one of the five principles would you start focusing on if you were looking to start increasing the soil health? Where do you start? Is there one better place?
Well, the first one that I just strongly recommend for people is to remove the tillage if possible. Now, I realize organic production, there's going to be some tillage, but we do have organic producers now that are going organic no-till, and it's not easy, but it can be done. But that tillage is just so destructive to soil health, to infiltration, soil aggregation, the amount of carbon in the soils. That's where we start with all of them and then build from there.
You mentioned in the chapter on rethinking livestock, you talk about epigenetics. How much of that is nature and how much of it's nurture? And what I mean by that is how much is the heifer learning from her mom and how much of it is actually passed on genetically?
Oh, I think it's a combination, but I think a great deal of it is learned. And, you know, it just so happens I was with Fred Provenza for 4 days here, and Fred Provenza is known worldwide for his work with epigenetics, and we talked specifically about that. For instance, on our operation, we calve between May 15th and the end of June, and then those calves are left on the cows all winter until early April. and they're out there grazing for most of the winter. Due to the way my land base is set up, we're not contiguous. I do end up bale grazing for a short amount of time, but those calves are learning how to survive in the winter on our environment, and they're doing it on very, very low quality forages. We do not supplement any protein supplement, no mineral, no salt, even nothing. Now, I'm not recommending everybody pull all those from their cow herds, but I'm just telling you that's what we do. But our goal, what's a cow's purpose? A cow's purpose is to take very low quality forage and produce a live calf every year while we're breeding. And I was talking to Fred that we've been doing this about 10 years, and we can really tell the difference in the younger animals on our place now. They flesh so much easier on low-quality forage. And Fred, you know, will tell you that's due to the epigenetics. And so how much of it is genetic, how much is due to the environment, I think it all comes into play. And I'm not smart enough to tell you which is which. That's for somebody a lot smarter than I.
You mentioned there, you know, some of the things that you guys are not doing. Is there a process that you recommend for people looking to wean themselves off of some of those things that to go through?
Well, what I tell people, and I don't care what it is, I don't care if it's going no-till, if it's doing cover crops, if it's you know, changing the genetics in your cow herd by leaving the calves on longer, what will allow you to sleep at night? That's what I tell people. You know, what can you do that it's not going to break the bank, so to speak? I never recommend anyone, you know, doing something that may put them in dire straits financially. So what will allow you to sleep at night? I went in 2012, I went and gave a presentation in Canada, and there was a guy sitting in the front row. He must have liked what he had to say it. What I had to say, because the first year he planted 8,000 acres of cover crops. Very first year, right off the bat, had never planted a cover crop up till then. You know, and now he's got 20,000 cropland acres, and he's got cover crops at one time or another on all of it, you know. But he was a risk taker. It didn't bother him, and financially he could take that risk. So that's a decision each farmer rancher needs to make based on their own situation.
Your book covers a lot of different topics and everything from grazing strategies to transition strategies. Can you talk a little bit about your transition strategy there at Brown's Ranch?
When I did it, are you asking? Or?
Well, yeah, I mean, just the overall strategy and how you implemented it and what the...
Well, mine was by the grace of God. I started no-tilling in 93, but then the years 95 and 96, we lost 100% of our crop to hail. 97, we dried out. 98, we lost 80% of our crop to hail. And I had no money. The bank wasn't going to loan me money anymore. So my transition strategy was just trying to stay alive and keep the banker at bay. I didn't have a choice, and I talk in the book how literally my first try at winter grazing, I did not have the money to buy twine, so I literally could not bale the forage, and I didn't have the money to buy twine, so instead we just let it stand and then started grazing it with cattle, and boy, you do that for a year or two, and it's like, why put up much forage anymore? Let's just do this every year. Cows have four legs for a reason. Make them use it, you know? And so I did it out of necessity, but what we're seeing today is the people that are moving down this path are doing it because economically and ecologically, it just makes sense, and it's much more profitable.
And what about the transition to Paul's generation and how is that laid out and some of those things that you talk about in the book?
Yeah, and you know, the greatest thing a parent could ever do, I think, is work with their children. And I knew from when Paul was young that he would want to come back and ranch and be on the ranch. I just knew it. Well, he didn't want to go to college. And looking back, I should not have forced him to go to college. He was very smart, but he just said, "Dad, they're not teaching me, you know, sound holistic principles. It's not making any sense." But I needed him to get away and grow up a little bit. Well, I'll never forget a phone call one night from him. He says, "You know, Dad, you preach diversity all the time, but yet all we run is beef cattle." He says, "I think we need some sheep and some laying hens." And what could I say? I said, "Yeah, go for it. Makes perfect sense, you know. And now we have sheep and hogs and chickens, and, you know, I think it's great." And it does make perfect ecological sense, and it certainly makes financial sense, because today's production model has become one of just a larger and larger land base. And I tell people we're actually shrinking the size of our land base because we're stacking so many enterprises. We don't need near as much land, so we're letting go of a bunch of rented ground. And it provides us much more opportunity to stack enterprises and then to manage in a way that is sound ecologically while being profitable.
That's kind of where I'm at in my ranching career, is looking for a way into the industry. And honestly, sheep is one of the more attractive ways in that I see. And you've got a heading in the chapter on transitioning to the next generation called that says every ranch needs a sheep. What have you guys seen as the benefit of sheep in your ranch?
You know, I enjoy cattle. I enjoy beef cattle. But in saying that, looking at the profitability of our enterprises, the honey enterprise is the most profitable per dollar invested, if you want to call bees livestock. Second is the pork, the hogs per dollar invested. Third is sheep. And the least profitable is the livestock. Well, sheep bring an added benefit, and they're going to eat a lot of the forages, the forbs, that livestock don't consume a lot of. And Fred Prevenza and I just talked about this over the weekend, how on ranches that run only sheep, their landscape becomes grass dominant. On ranches that run mainly cattle, their grasslands, if they're not severely overgrazing, become forb dominant. But if you run both species together, you get a balance, and that's what's needed in a healthy ecosystem. So sheep to us are a wonderful tool in the way that we manage them a lot like the cattle. I mean, they lamb in May and June, and we leave the lambs on them until after Christmas, and we just don't put a lot of time, effort, and energy in the sheep, and they just tend to make money. That's what they do.
I was talking to a guy here just this last weekend, and he said that when he feeds his cows, he doesn't figure anything extra in for the sheep, and they clean up what the cows don't eat, and they get by on that. They don't have to. He doesn't have to go out of his way to make sure that he's putting out enough for the sheep too, and they get by just fine on that. And
great. I laugh at so often people think, "Oh, sheep, they're all this work," and they're a little more work for fencing. I'll grant that. You know, they're the first few years I had them. I told people our sheep are on a planned grazing system. Wherever they plan on going, that's where they're at, you know. But we've been able to conquer that. But the thing about sheep is they're just very adaptable. And people always think, "Oh, but you got to worm them and all that." Not if your management, if your stewardship is good. We haven't, you know, we've had sheep now for boy, I'd have to count up 7 years or whatever. We have yet to worm a single animal. And we don't use any vaccines or anything on any of our livestock. And the health of our livestock now compared to when I was in the, what I call the industrialized commoditized market, it's just amazing. It's just, the animals are so much healthier, and we're saving all those costs all the time of doing all that. It allows us the opportunity to stack more enterprises.
And that's related to soil health, the reason that you're not necessarily needing wormers and those different things is because the soil is healthy and it's taking care of a lot of that for you. Is that accurate?
Well, I think it's, I wouldn't just quantify it as soil health. I think it's ecosystem health, because our rangelands, pasture lands are much healthier. We have more diversity in there. You know, we're moving the animals on a regular basis, and that allows adequate recovery time, so the plants themselves are healthier. They are cycling more nutrients, and I tell people we don't use any salt or mineral, but we did. But it got to the point where, you know, we were running about 1,000 head of beef animals on this place, and it got to the point where we weren't hardly going through, 30 bags of mineral a year. Well, it wasn't even worth our time, to do that. But that's because the biology can cycle the nutrients needed, and the plants are much more nutrient dense, so then it flows through to the animals.
How much of an impact would it have on your operation if you were to stop direct marketing as far as profitability is concerned?
Well, I tell people this. Okay, last figures I saw, the average food dollar a farmer gets 12.6 cents. So direct marketing allows us to get a much bigger piece of the pie. In saying that, we have truly become low-cost producers. I can produce a bushel of corn, a bushel of barley, a pound of lamb, a pound of beef at a much lower cost than most people can. And so if I was to have to sell those on a commodity type market, I would still be profitable compared to others in the industry, but call me greedy, I'm a capitalist. I want to, I tell people, that 12.6 cents, no, I want as much of the whole dollar as I can get, because that's just me, that's what capitalism is about. Let's put more in our pockets and keep it in the rural communities. And so that's what we're trying to do, and it's one of the reasons we direct market.
Gabe, I really appreciate your time today. Where could people go to find out where you're going to be next? I know you're doing a lot of traveling this time of year, and you're going to be at the South Dakota Farm and Ranch Conference put on by the South Dakota Young Farm and Ranch Committee, of which I am a member. So I'm looking forward to seeing you there in February. But where can people go to find out where you're going to be?
Yeah, and unfortunately, I've not done a good job of keeping up any website or anything as far as where I'm going to be. I'll be in in our area. I'll be in Redfield, South Dakota on the 30th of January. Those are the two closest events where I'll be at.
Friday, February 1st, we've got you down for the South Dakota Farm and Ranch Conference, sponsored by the South Dakota Young Farmers and Ranch Committee. So we're looking forward to seeing you there. There'll be links to that in the show notes page at workingcows.net/67. If you'd like more information or pick up a copy of Gabe's book, there'll be links to all that at the show notes page at workingcows.net/67. So Gabe, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate the opportunity to sit down with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
As I said in the show opener, we are starting off 2019 with a bang. We got a bunch of national and international guests coming on over the next few weeks. Next up, I'm going to be talking about bale grazing. Specifically, we're going to talk about the waste and how do you manage the waste. And if you could see me right now, you would see that I'm doing scare quotes around waste. And we're going to talk to Steve Kenyon about whether or not waste is something we should be concerned about when it comes to bale grazing. So please tune in for that. Like and share the show. And if you want to, go out and support it on Patreon. Really excited about the community that we're developing through the Patreon supporters and the upcoming exciting things that we're doing there. So next week, as I said, tune in for my discussion with Steve Kenyon about waste, quote-unquote, in bale grazing. Also got some good episodes coming up with Roland Cruz and Dave Pratt coming back on the show, both of them returning again. So really excited about this start to 2019, and we will see you next week with Steve Kenyon on bale grazing.
Cows. We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.